expecting about 35 students with our Court with Class program this morning, which some of you are familiar with. We invite high school students from around the state to come and join us for an oral argument. They have been given materials about the case, including the briefs. They may have talked to some of you or others about the case. And then they join us for the oral argument and then speak with a justice of the court about the case. And so there might be a slight movement of people when they arrive. They are from Central Wisconsin Christian School. So that's why I'm telling you this. I don't want you to be disturbed by it. Until they arrive, we'll hear you. And we'll hear you after they arrive. And I'll call the first case, 012649, Martin Wenke versus Gale Company. And representing Martin Wenke is Lynn Laufenberg. And if you would proceed, counsel.
Thank you, Chief Justice Abramson. My name is Lynn Laufenberg, and I do represent the Wenkes in this matter, and by extension, the Lewis family in the Lewis versus J.I. case matter, which is held in abeyance in the Second District Court of Appeals pending this court's decision, and the Ball family and the Murner families in their cases, which are being held in abeyance from a decision standpoint by the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals pending this court's decision in this case. The issue in this case is whether there is any compelling reason to say that the Court of Appeals was wrong when it ruled in 1990 that Wisconsin's borrowing statute permits a Wisconsin defendant to be held to account in a Wisconsin courtroom for negligent conduct which occurred in Wisconsin, but which happened to cause harm to a resident of another state. Even though, as in this case, the foreign state, in this case Iowa, has in the interim between the wrongful conduct and the injury enacted a statute of repose which would preclude recovery in the foreign jurisdiction. At issue in this case is the continued viability of the precedent of the published decision of the Court of Appeals in 1990, more than 12 years ago, in Leverance versus U.S. Fidelity and Guarantee, which held that by reason of its plain language, the borrowing statute, Section 89307, has application only to a foreign state's statute of limitations and not a foreign state's statute of repose. The precedent of Leverance is being belatedly challenged because of the rationale of this Court's decision last summer in Landis versus Physicians Insurance Company of Wisconsin. And this Court has accepted certification from the Court of Appeals on the question of whether Leverance has been, as the Court of Appeals put it, functionally overruled by Landis. I think we can look at the issue in this case in another way and say that if the Court of Appeals in 1990 had the benefit of this Court's decision in Landis in 2001, would it have decided Leverance any differently? Or would this Court's decision in Landis have led the Court of Appeals to determine that Wisconsin's borrowing statute was intended by the legislature to apply both to a foreign state's statute of repose and a foreign state's statute of limitations?
Mr. Laufenberg, do you read the Landis decision as being limited to a discussion of Chapter 655, or do you read it more broadly than that?
I do not read it more broadly than that, Justice Crooks. It is important to recognize that there was no mention in Landis of either leverance or the borrowing statute. The statute at issue, actually there were a couple of interplay statutes at issue in Landis that involved the tolling provisions that govern the filing of medical malpractice claims. The only relevance that Landis appears to have, at least in the eyes of the Court of Appeals, certainly in the eyes of the trial courts, which granted motions to dismiss this action, is the rationale expressed by Justice Prosser in the majority decision in Landis that the legislature has not expressly recognized what the majority described as a judicial distinction between statutes of limitations and statutes of repose. And on that basis, concluded that language in the tolling provision, which the phrase at issue was any applicable statute of limitations, could have meant either a statute of limitations or a statute of repose or both, and therefore was ambiguous. That's as far as I believe the precedent of Landis takes us in this case, because the question presented by the rationale in Landis is whether the Court of Appeals, informed, had it been informed by Landis, might have concluded that the phrase foreign period of limitation, as used in the borrowing statute, was not clearly referring only to a statute of limitations, but instead might also be ambiguous. And that's as far as you get with the benefit of Landis, respectfully. From there, one, if you conclude, and I think there's reason to conclude that the plain language rationale of Landis of leverance was good rationale and continues to be good rationale, but if you conclude that in light of Landis, the phrase foreign period of limitation could mean either foreign statute of limitation or foreign statute of repose, you only get to the question of statutory construction, which is the heart and soul of this Court's decision in Landis. There was, after a determination that the phrase foreign or any period of any statute of limitations was ambiguous, a very careful analysis applying longstanding rules of statutory construction that looked at the history, the context, and the purpose of the tolling provisions at issue in that case, and concluded, in light of that consideration and the unique presentation of the statutes in that case, that the legislature could only have intended to include all limitation periods, not just statutes of limitations.
Well, then I assume from the argument that that 89307 we'd have to interpret or look at the interpretation of the Court of Appeals to see what that language would mean for purposes of repose and limitations.
Justice, I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, and the other part of that question is, then I would assume that everywhere that the statutes use the word statute of limitations, should the issue come up, we'd have to see, does it mean just one or does it mean both?
I think that's the conclusion one could draw from the reading of the Landis decision. And so it would require an individual analysis of the statutes at issue. Where I think the defendants are wrong in this case, and where I think the trial courts were wrong in this case, is in the conclusion that in the argument that this court in Landis said that statutes of limitations and statutes of repose will be equated for all purposes whenever construing a statutory enactment that uses one or the other terms or some variant of those terms. That clearly was not the holding in Landis. It is, I think it's important also that this...
What was the holding in Landis if that wasn't it?
The holding in Landis was that the phrase used in the statutes at issue was ambiguous. And therefore, from that conclusion, one gets to a issue of statutory construction. And the statutory construction rules, as applied in Landis, led to a particular conclusion, that in that instance the legislature must have intended to include both statutes of limitations and statutes of repose. But that doesn't mean that in every case where the statutory purpose, context, and history is different, that that was the legislative intent.
Well, counsel, I might buy that argument, but for the dissent, which clearly took the position, which I don't think was referred to in the majority opinion, that essentially the two have merged.
I agree that the dissent was concerned that in which Justice Babich joined in Landis, was concerned that the court appeared to depart from some very express statements in the Acre decision only 1 year earlier, which emphasized the distinctions between statutes of repose and statutes of limitations. And I can understand the concern of the dissent that there is some apparent conflict between the majority decisions in Acre and the majority and the one in Landis in that respect. But I don't think that leads to the conclusion that the majority decision in Landis intended to say that the two terms are merged for all purposes whenever you have a issue of statutory construction. I think an important underlying question in this case that has to be kept in mind is that this Court has repeatedly stated that published decisions of the Court of Appeals are binding precedent, required to be so by statute, and will be given the same force and effect as a decision of this Court on questions of law unless and until overturned. Also important to consider is that when this Court has also held that the rule that a construction given to a statute by an appellate court becomes a part of the statute applies as well to a court of appeals constructions of statutes. Why is that significant? It's significant because in the more than 12 years since Leverance was decided, the legislature has not seen fit to act to correct what Gale now contends was an erroneous construction of that statute. That is of some significance. And this Court recently in 2001 in State versus Dueng Mala, I may have butchered the name, said that when we have a situation like this, where you have a Court of Appeals construction of a statute, which is given stare decisis effect, you must have a compelling reason to say that that construction was wrong, especially in light of the passage of time since Leverance, which has seen no legislative action to correct the construction.
Mr. Laufenberg, did you check the briefs in Landis, perchance? I did not.
I did not.
Okay. I was just curious to see if Leverance was cited, because, as you said, it's not cited in the Landis.
It is not. The only place that I know that Leverance has been cited in a published decision of this Court since it was decided is the Sharp case, Sharp versus J.I. Case Corporation, and there it was cited in a footnote. And this Court in that case said that we need not address whether Leverance was correctly decided because it concluded that there was no reason to go beyond the issue as raised because the foreign statute of repose in that case wouldn't have applied anyway to post-manufacture negligence.
Could I ask you, on 893.071, application of foreign statutes of limitation, what would have been the policy rationale for the legislature to distinguish between a statute of limitations in a state like Iowa and a statute of repose?
That's a great question, and it's at the heart of the statutory construction issue in this case. And to get to that, the answer to that question, you must do what this Court did in Landis. Look at the history, context, and purpose of the statute. And this Court's decision in the Gerton versus Harbor Insurance Company case, and this Court's decision in the Scott case. In those cases, this Court emphasized the importance of the history of the borrowing statute and the Judicial Council Committee notes to the borrowing statute. The history was such that the 89307 form that we work with today is an amendment to a previous borrowing statute. In Gerton, this Court observed that under the previous borrowing statute, a foreign defendant or foreign plaintiff could bring an action in this state as long as the Wisconsin statute of limitations on that claim had not run, even if the foreign state's statute of limitations had run. The amendment to the statute was intended, as you, if you read the interplay between 89305 and 89307 and the Judicial Council Committee notes to those sections, to give the same effect to the running of a foreign state's statute of limitations as is given to the running of a Wisconsin statute of limitations. And that effect is that once a statute of limitations has run, it not only eliminates the remedy for the plaintiff, it establishes or creates a right in a defendant which is subject to constitutional protection. That feature, that second feature of the running of a statute of limitations under Wisconsin law, is critical to an understanding of the purpose of the borrowing statute, given its history. Because the court in Maryland Casualty Company, which is quoted in the note to 89305, back in the 1930s, observed that in Wisconsin, statutes of limitations in that respect have a different effect than a statute of repose, which only eliminates the plaintiff's remedy, does not grant and create a constitutionally protected property right. So what the legislature appears to have intended to do, when you consider both the context, the history, and the notes, is to give to a defendant the same constitutional protection it would enjoy from the running of the statute of limitations in Wisconsin to the running of the statute of limitations in another state. So that effect does not occur. And Gale and the other defendants in these cases has not cited a case which supports the proposition that the running of a statute of repose likewise creates constitutionally protected property rights. Now, the other clue to the proper interpretation of 89307 can be found in this case, this Court's decision in the Scott case. In Scott, a minor resident of Canada was severely injured by a product which was manufactured by the Pats Corporation, also a Wisconsin resident corporation, designed, manufactured in Wisconsin, just as the hay baler which took Marty Wenke's arm was designed and manufactured by Gale in Wisconsin. The miner in Scott was living with his parents, and under a unique provision, tolling provision of Canada law, the tolling for a miner's claim does not apply or is limited when the miner actually resides with the parent. Not so under Wisconsin law. Wisconsin law tolls statutes of limitations for minors without regard to whether they reside or don't reside with their parents. The lawsuit was brought in Wisconsin within the statute of limitations time limit under Canada law, but the defendant argued that because the tolling provision of Canada law did not apply, the action was untimely under the borrowing statute. And this Court said, no, we are only concerned about the application of a statute of limitations. And once a foreign cause of action becomes a Wisconsin claim, it is treated as a Wisconsin cause of action if it's timely under Wisconsin and the foreign state statute of limitations, and only the Wisconsin tolling provisions will apply. Now, if Gail's argument in this case is correct, this court would have reached a different result in Scott, because Gail contends that not only does that the borrowing statute effectively borrows virtually every time limitation that might exist in a foreign state's law. And you must look to the foreign state's law in those provisions in addition to statutes of limitations to determine whether the action can proceed. That isn't what this court said in Scott. We become, this lawsuit was timely filed in Wisconsin under Iowa's 2-year statute of limitations. And subdivision 2, which helps also in the construction of subdivision 1, says that the shortest of the time period, limitation period, whether it be Wisconsin or foreign state, will control the timeliness of the lawsuit. In this case, Iowa has a 2-year statute of limitations on personal injury claims. Wisconsin has a 3-year statute of limitations. Had the Wenkes filed their lawsuit outside the 2-year limitation period, but within the Wisconsin 3-year limitation period, they would be out of luck under the borrowing statute, subdivision 2. They did not do that. That lawsuit was filed within the 2-year statute, Iowa statute of limitations. Gail, in its brief, raised an argument that the construction given to the statute by the court in Leverance and advocated by us to be maintained here would create confusion if there was both a foreign state statute of limitations and foreign state statute of repose and a Wisconsin statute of limitations and statute of repose, as there is in medical malpractice cases. And they created this example of a Iowa resident physician who moves to Wisconsin and is sued on an Iowa malpractice cause of action in Wisconsin as to how do we decide which statute of repose applies. Well, it's easy, because once it's filed in Wisconsin, it becomes a Wisconsin cause of action, and the Wisconsin statute of repose would apply, just as the Wisconsin tolling provision for minor claims was held to apply in Scott.
If I can just interrupt you, we took this case on just one issue.
Yes.
And it seems to me you're presently maybe talking about the second issue.
I don't think so. And I don't think so because of the way this court addressed the identical issue in Scott. It's not a question of it helps in Scott to understand what role foreign statutes of repose play then in the context of the borrowing statute.
Well, should you prevail on your having Leverance apply, does this have to be remanded for the issue of what choice of law applies?
I do not believe so. And I do not believe so because of this court's statement in Gerton and in Scott and in Andrews, I believe, which is a court of appeals decision, which said that the legislature intended to avoid choice of law issues on timeliness when it enacted the borrowing statute.
If we hold that way, are we really then holding on the second issue that we didn't take?
I don't think so. I think that may be an issue that I don't think it be holding on the second issue. That issue's already been decided, Justice Abramson. I don't think there's a new ruling required. That, I believe, is an issue that's been firmly decided by this court.
Okay. You believe it's firmly decided, but the very fact that we say it's firmly decided is deciding that issue here.
I guess it's reiterating a previous decision, yes.
All right. I got the point.
Okay. Okay. There have been suggestions made of forum shopping and of the public policy arguments supporting statutes of repose. Neither of those arguments are really relevant to the issue this court has to decide as to the viability of Leverance. This is not a forum shopping case. This is a forum selection case. It's difficult to understand how a Wisconsin corporation could be heard to argue that it's being unfairly held to account in a Wisconsin courtroom for decisions it made in Wisconsin about a product that caused injury, just happened to cause injury, in another state. Even more so in this case, where the Iowa statute of repose was enacted a mere matter of 2 months or 3 months before the injury occurred to Martin Wenke. So it's hard for Gale to argue in this case, and for John Deere and the other cases pending in the Seventh Circuit, that they had some reliance when they sold a machine in Iowa that they'd be protected by a statute of repose, because the sales occurred long before the Iowa statute of repose was enacted. Similarly, with regard to the public policy arguments supporting statutes of repose, the answer is simple. This court in Kozlowski back in 1978 or 79, in dealing with an old product, urged the legislature to consider the enactment of a statute of repose in Wisconsin. Legislature has not done so. So Wisconsin's public policy is at issue here, not Iowa's public policy. And as far as we can, this court in Kozlowski said that the public policy considerations underlying a statute of repose are uniquely for a legislature, not this court. So even if this court were to consider, as it did in Kozlowski, that statutes of repose and product liability actions would be a potentially good thing, the process which would lead to that decision should be made by the legislature, and it hasn't. It's been starkly silent, despite the invitation by this court in Kozlowski.
Counsel, you responded to questions as to what the issue is and the sole issue is. The issue as articulated by the certification is whether or not Landis functionally overruled Leverance. Is that the issue before us, or is the issue before us whether Leverance should be overruled?
I think the issue is whether Landis functionally overrules Leverance. That's the issue that was certified and the issue that this court accepted for resolution. And if you want to say that the issue is whether Leverance should be, quote, overruled, there must be some compelling reason to do so. And I suggest that even if you conclude that the plain language rationale of Leverance was misplaced in light of this court's discussion in Landis, that all you get to is a question of statutory construction. And when you do the statutory construction under the principles announced and followed by this court in Landis, the history, the context, and the purpose of the statute, as I said before, you come to the same conclusion, that Leverance was correctly decided and should not be overruled. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Representing the Gale Company, Francis H. Lococo of Quarles & Brady.
Good morning, Chief Justice. Thank you. My name is Frank Lococo, and I represent the people at Gale Company in West Bend, Wisconsin. May it please this honorable court. This case involves a foreign cause of action as this court and the borrowing statute have defined it. It involves Mr. Wenke, an Iowa resident, using a piece of equipment in Iowa that was manufactured in South Dakota but designed here by my clients. It was sold to someone other than Mr. Wenke back in 1981. So as a foreign cause of action, the borrowing statute applies and needs to be applied. And in keeping with what this court discussed in Girton versus Harbor Insurance, the legislative intent to use the shortest possible time limitation in arriving at the answer of whether the case can be maintained, the simple answer is that it cannot and it may not. Under Iowa Statute Section 614.1 sub 2A, the time limitation for bringing this lawsuit expired. It expired when this product became older than 15 years old. And coming on the heels of this court's decisions in Aker and Landis, the conclusion that Judge Farragher's decision reached, that it must be sustained, is obvious. There is simply no way to reconcile the court's decisions in Landis and Aker with the Court of Appeals' 1990 decision in Leverance, which we believe was wrongly decided in the first instance. Judge Farragher dismissed this case with similar thoughts. Judge Barry and Racine understood this in the Lewis versus Case action. Judge Randa understood this in the Eastern District of Wisconsin in the Myrner and Ball versus Deere actions. And the Court of Appeals in this case also recognized this in certifying the question before this court. In our judgment, appellant's counsel wishes this court to engage in what I would call mental gymnastics and leaps of illogic to avoid this obvious conclusion that has been reached by several trial courts and by the Court of Appeals. The holding in Leverance is no longer good law. It is no longer good law because the holding in Leverance is inconsistent with this court's decisions in Aker and Landis. Not only are statutes of repose constitutional, but the borrowing statute, as drafted by the legislature in our state in the late 1970s, was intended to pick up the foreign period of limitation, which in this case is Section 614.12a, the specific declaration with respect to a products liability case. The Landis case dealt not just with Chapter 655, but Chapter 893, which is the chapter at issue in this case. Chapter 893 deals with limitations of actions, and as Justice Prosser noted in the majority opinion, the legislature did not write with a fine point. It discussed limitations of actions, statute of limitations, statutes of limitations, time limitations, many different formulations for the same concept. And in that case, this court held, in analyzing Chapter 655 and its interplay with Chapter 893, that the legislature intended to pick up statutes of limitation and statutes of repose.
So it's your position that every single statutory phrase that deals with statute of limitations, regardless of how it's stated, includes both?
I believe, Chief Justice Abramson, that if you read Landis in connection with the borrowing statute and you pick some other jurisdiction where you have to borrow that jurisdiction's time limitation, you look at the specific time limitation that applies to that cause of action. And then in keeping with this court's decision in Girton, you apply the shortest possible time limitation. In this case, it's 15 years post-manufacture. It is that simple. Yes.
So it's your position that every time the statute uses words like statute of limitations, limitations of actions, it includes both?
Every is...
I know.
Is a lot.
That's why I asked the question.
But I think certainly every time that formula is used, particularly in Chapter 893, which was all passed at the same time in 1979, I think that's certainly the case.
Despite the Judicial Council note to 893.05, it seems to say that the two are different. I know your brief argues otherwise, but I'm not quite sure I understand why.
Pardon me, I missed the last
one. Said notes to 893 would indicate there's a significant difference in Wisconsin between the two.
I would respectfully disagree with the Chief Justice's reading of those notes. I think that that has been one of the mischaracterizations both by the Court of Appeals in Leverance and picked up by the appellants in their briefing here. The Judicial Council Committee notes and its reference to Maryland versus Blasny are grossly mischaracterized. In that 1944 decision, all that the that decision had nothing to do with what we as judges and lawyers would call a statute of repose. It spoke of the Wisconsin policy that a statute of limitation is not a statute of repose, meaning it doesn't just destroy the remedy. It creates a vested right in the person who benefits from it, in this case, Gale. And that has been this court's position, and it, in fact, is the position of the Iowa Supreme Court. We cited Albrecht versus GM, that statute, and even in Landis, if the court, I would direct the court's attention to paragraph 50 and similar language, that statutes of repose and statutes of limitation, when they expire, create, they act like a statute of limitations as the Maryland court discussed it. That is, it destroys the right of the putative plaintiff, destroys the remedy, and creates a vested property right. So in this case, the 15-year statute of repose from Iowa, when it lapsed, Gale, what was created for Gale was a vested property right, that it would be protected from suit from this very old product that had been in the market for many, 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 many years. So once I think you take the Maryland case, its language, into the context in which it was actually given, the argument that the case actually supports our view, that statute and the court's view in Landis and in Aker, but in particular Landis, that statutes of repose, statutes of limitation, they are all time-limiting statutes that have to be applied. And in this case, you borrow the most restrictive time limit, which in this case is the statute of repose.
Mr. Lococo, in writing the Landis case, we did a computer search for the term statute of repose in Wisconsin statutes and could not find that they'd ever been used. What about Iowa? I mean, is there a reference in the statutes of Iowa to statutes of repose?
In the statutes of Iowa. This statute in particular, 614.1 sub 2A, does not speak of statutes of repose. We did not run a computer search of Iowa. And I would just note for Justice Prosser that in Albrecht versus GM, the Iowa Supreme Court states that the legislature itself has not expressly distinguished statutes of limitation from statutes of repose. That's at 648 Northwest 2nd, 87.
Well, the statute in question is interpreted the way you want. Does that decide the choice of law issue?
I think it does. I think that the borrowing statute itself, Section 893.07, is intended to be a legislative enactment of a choice of law policy decision. We will choose the shortest possible time limitation within which someone can bring a cause of action. If Wisconsin's is shorter and it's expired, you cannot maintain the cause of action. If the foreign jurisdiction's is shorter and it's expired, you cannot maintain a cause of action. And in that way, it is a choice of law provision. Picking up on one of the other earlier questions, we candidly can't imagine how Leverance is any longer good law. But as it sat earlier, prior to Landis and prior to Aker, but in particular Landis, the fact is that 893.07 does not discuss, by its terms, in the statute itself, statutes of limitation or statutes of repose. It's, again, in the whole chapter, 893, they're all different formulations used. And because of that, if Leverance were to be good law, under a standard conflicts approach, you would, in this case, you would pick up all the contacts in Iowa and apply what the legislature, we believe, would want applied here, which is 614.1 sub 2A. So to answer your question, I think the statute itself is a choice of law legislative enactment. in order to give the courts some certainty, finality, predictability, and parties. I know whether I have a cause of action that can be maintained or I do not, so that we're not going through the five-step conflicts process every single time. I wanted to make a few other comments about leverance. As the Court knows, it was decided by the Court of Appeals in 1990. The decision itself discusses many different legal issues. It's approximately 35 pages in length. The statute of repose issue takes up three and a half pages in the Wisconsin Reporter. And the only analysis, brief as it is maybe a couple of sentences. The appellants have gone on to point out in their brief that this court did not accept review of leverance, and we all know that the failure of this court to accept review doesn't carry any precedential weight. But what is interesting to note is that in the cross petition, in the petitions and cross petitions filed with this court, this issue was not raised for review. So this court was never asked to pass on that particular issue in leverance.
Counsel? I asked your opposing counsel about the issue in this case, and the certified issue is whether or not Landis functionally overruled leverance. An argument can be made that, and is made, that you look at Landis, and Landis is a statutory construction case, and the discussion is thorough. It looks at 655, it looks at specific language in 655 sub 4 and discusses that. So Landis is applicable to 655 sub 4. That's what the discussion is all about. It didn't mention leverance. Perhaps the parties never mentioned it in their briefs. Who knows? But let me throw that in.
I'd like to say I know, but I don't.
Okay. And it was never brought up. So it obviously didn't overtly overrule it because it didn't even reference it. And maybe the parties didn't even reference it. And if you interpret it just as a 655 sub 4 statutory construction case, you can say it didn't functionally overrule leverance. Now, maybe leverance should be overruled, but that's not the question before us. Is there any argument that you advance that we should not deal with this very narrowly?
I think that whether Landis functionally overrules leverance or whether you should overrule leverance are on a collision course, candidly. I think Landis is not narrowly drawn and really shouldn't be that narrowly drawn. And it does pick up provisions, particularly the tolling provision in Chapter 893. I admit that in Landis this Court does not mention leverance. However, I think that that puts up the argument, and I think appellants make this argument. They seem to be saying that when this Court issues a decision, it has the burden of spelling out specifically and exactly how a particular decision is, will, and should affect each and every prior decision of not only this Court, but the Court of Appeals.
That's a pretty heavy burden.
It sure is. And reasonable, I was going to say people, but really reasonable lawyers and judges should be able to read your pronouncements, find them predictable, final, reliable, et cetera, and apply those pronouncements to similar facts. And here we have that because we're dealing with the exact same chapter of the statutes enacted in the same year with the same historical context. Justice Prosser's very eloquent dissertation on the searching that was done, Black's Law Dictionary, et cetera, show that in drafting Chapter 893, the legislature was dealing with periods of limitation, time limitations, however that is denominated. And because of that, I think the pronouncements in Landis are that broad so that they pick up, for sure, leverance. There may be other cases that you and I aren't aware of yet. Maybe you are aware of other cases that the pronouncements in Landis have picked up that you'll see in the future. So to get back to your question, I don't think the certified question is really substantively different from whether you have to find that leverance is good law. The question is it good law today? We believe it wasn't good law in 1990. This is the first time you've had a chance to really hone in on that issue, to say it is, particularly in light of Landis and Acre, no longer good law. In Leverance, as this Court knows, citing Beard, a federal case, there was much concern about the constitutionality issues that have been raised, that had been raised historically over statutes of repose and their interplay with Article I, Section 9 of the Wisconsin Constitution. I think Acre took care of that for the first time. And candidly, that explains primarily legislative acquiescence, as argued by the appellants in this case. Why would the legislature waste time passing a statute post-1990, post-Leverance, that it believed, given what Leverance said and Beard said and Rosenthal and the other cases mentioned, would be struck down as unconstitutional? That was handled by Acre. Landis came forward, and we're here. So I think legislative acquiescence is much ado about nothing, and there is a compelling reason to deal with Leverance on its face in the context of this certified question. I want to...
May I?
Sure.
This is my problem. I apologize. In response to the Chief's question of whether then your argument means that every time there is in a statute a word like statute of limitations or limitation of action, every time that phrase or a similar phrase appears, is it your position it includes both? And you paused and kind of said every is a big word,
right?
And I forgot what the rest of the story was. Is it every?
Yes.
In fact, in my mind, I thought you were going to say almost every.
No,
but
and
you didn't.
What's
the answer?
I try cases, and so I'm not smart enough to really know whether every fits. I do know that I think it applies to every contemporaneous enactment. And in this case, we've got a 1979, Chapter 893. The legislative mind was on the same had the same context within which it was working.
Why do you say contemporaneous, and how do you define contemporaneous?
That this chapter, the borrowing statute, and the section of 893 at issue in Landis were both passed at the same time in 1979, when this entire chapter was reworked, reordered, and reorganized. And so all of the historical analysis that the majority's opinion in Landis goes through is equally applicable to the borrowing statute. And so from that perspective, which would include Chapter 893, enactment at that time with that historical context should be read with Landis as its guiding post.
Are you then suggesting since the enactment in 1979, that's how you define, that's the time period, that every legislative action since then, which uses a similar phraseology, references and includes both?
I think that you might be able to be that broad because, as was pointed out, the legislature in this state has never used the formulation statute of repose. They've used all these other formulations, but never statute of repose. And they're all time limitations.
If you don't say it's that broad, then you're back to statutory construction with regard to each individual statute and its wording and looking at the history, context, purpose. So it seems to me like you have to say it's that broad.
And maybe we're just miscommunicating. I am saying it's that broad.
Okay.
I don't know, as I sit here, what's in Chapter 423. And I would, just being careful, I'd want to look at that. But I believe it is that broad.
Thank you.
Okay.
I think Mr. Laufenberg said something about the Iowa statute of repose being enacted relatively recently. Is that correct?
He said that it was within 2 months of Mr. Wenke's accident accident and injury. I believe that's correct.
Has that statute been challenged, the constitutionality of that statute been challenged in Iowa?
Yes, Your Honor, and it's been upheld. I think we cited that case, Albrecht versus GM. I gave the cite earlier. It's 648 Northwest 2nd, 87.
Is there anything retroactive about its application in this case?
I don't believe there's a problem with it being retroactive, if that answers. I don't think there's an issue. When it was enacted, it became the law for any products that were then older than 15 years, including the Gale Baylor that had been in Iowa since 1981.
The statute then just immunize any product, no matter how bad it was?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor, because the legislature there made a policy decision that older products are harder to defend. People, for the same reasons that statutes of limitation and statutes of repose are upheld, people die, evidence goes away, documents are no longer available, memories fade, etc. And so they made that policy decision that a 15-year statute of repose would act to provide a constitutionally protected right to manufacturers of products that were that old. And presumably everyone in Iowa had notice or constructive notice that that would be the case. You could use a product that's older than 15 years, but you're not going to be able to bring a products liability case with respect to that design. And statutes of limitation and statutes of repose really don't, from a court's perspective, you really don't make moral judgments on whether that was the right time frame. Maybe it should have been 20 years. Maybe it should have been 40 years. Maybe it should have been 2 years. What is the period? Does it apply? If it applies, then the action cannot be maintained. I would finally point out, to specifically answer your question, Albrecht, I think, does make clear that retroactivity is not an issue. So if you look at Albrecht versus GM. I do want to spend a few minutes talking about the Scott case, which Mr. Laufenberg discussed. This was a brand new issue raised in both Mr. Laufenberg's reply and in the Waddle amicus brief. The Scott case was raised for the very first time then, and using that case, the appellants seem to argue that finding in favor of the respondents here, Gale, would be inconsistent with other decisions of this court, and specifically they go on to cite Scott. I am truly puzzled at the reference to Scott. I continue to be puzzled by the reference to Scott and the interplay of the Scott holding with these issues, because it strikes me that that is mixing apples and bananas in an important way. In Scott, as Mr. Laufenberg discussed, this court was deciding whether the borrowing statute also borrowed a tolling provision from the province of Alberta, Canada, in applying the foreign period of limitation, or whether the borrowing statute borrowed only the time limitation, which was a 2-year statute of limitation, and then look to Wisconsin law to determine if there was any statutory provision that would have told that statute of limitations in order to allow the case to move forward. In that case, this court held that the borrowing statute only borrows the time limitation but not the tolling provision, and specifically this court wrote, while the borrowed foreign statute determines the applicable period of limitation, we look to the Wisconsin tolling law to see if that period has expired. And I think this is where the fruit mixing occurs. There's no Wisconsin tolling provision at issue here. The time limitation from Alberta was applied here in Wisconsin, the most restrictive one, 2 years, And then the court searched for any Wisconsin tolling provision. In this case, the time limitation is 15 years post-sale, and that's a time that everyone, both parties, agrees has passed. Under the terms of the Iowa statute, this case cannot be maintained. The question is there any tolling provision then in Wisconsin that could be applied to preserve the plaintiff's case? That was the issue in Scott. There is no tolling provision here. So Scott does not apply. It is completely consistent with this court's holding in Landis and what we believe is the current state of leverance. So as I said, I continue to be puzzled by the citation to Scott. One final point about the illogic of appellant's position. In asking you to uphold leverance, even in light of Landis and Aker, you would have to find that the legislature in 1979 intended to vote to extend to non-Wisconsin residents injured in another state more time to sue a Wisconsin citizen than if they would have in the foreign jurisdiction where they were injured. That in drafting Section 893.07, the legislature contemplated giving a non-Wisconsin resident more time to sue a Wisconsin citizen than he or she or it would have had in its own state, and that makes no sense, especially in light of this court's pronouncement in Girton that the legislative intent is to apply the shortest possible time limitation. This court should not undo its decision in Landis that periods of limitations include both statutes of limitation and statutes of repose. As such, using Section 893.07 and applying it to the facts of this case, it is clear that the foreign period of limitation which applies to Mr. Wenke's case is the 15-year product liability statute of repose. Appellants are trying to excise from the analysis the Iowa statute of repose with no authority in this state or Iowa for doing so. This is an integral part of the time limitation passed by the Iowa legislature. Giving full faith and credit to this Iowa statute under our borrowing statute, Mr. Wenke's claim cannot be sustained. And we believe that judgment of the circuit court should be affirmed and the certified question should be answered in the affirmative. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Laufenberg, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. I'm a bit confused. In the trial court, before Landis was decided, Gale took the position that the borrowing statute and its application in leverance was good law, but that it didn't resolve the question of whether we still need to look at the application of foreign statutes of repose and argued that you still have to do a choice of law analysis. When Landis was decided, the tune changed, and now, in light of Landis, leverance was never good law. And, as counsel has said before this court today, we shouldn't do and don't need to do a choice of law analysis. And counsel takes the position that Landis clearly sets leverance aside. With all due respect, if it was so clear that Landis overruled leverance, we would not have a certified question of whether Landis functionally overrules leverance.
Well, the Court of Appeals has very limited, if any, ability to make that kind of decision and overrule its own cases.
I accept that, Your Honor, and that's another reason why the binding precedent of leverance should not be lightly set aside by this Court. Given the time that's passed, we've had suggestions here that the legislature would not have acted to change the result in leverance because it was concerned that this court would hold a statute of repose unconstitutional in any event. I'm puzzled by that argument since this court is the court in 1979 which expressly invited our legislature to adopt a statute of repose in product liability actions, and the legislature didn't act in response to that invitation. The fact of the matter is, the constitutionality of a statute of repose, whether in Iowa or Wisconsin, is not at issue in this case. The court in Leverance did not base its decision on its concern that applications of statutes of repose to Wisconsin claims would be deemed unconstitutional. It discussed that issue, but then expressly set it aside and said, we are basing our decision on the plain language of the statute. Gail's position here with regard to statutory construction would, in effect, have it ignore one of the keys to statutory construction in this and any other case, assuming that that phrase, foreign period of limitation, is ambiguous. It would have this court ignore the Judicial Council Committee notes and the reference to Maryland Casualty versus Belasny and this court's pronouncement back in 1934 that in Wisconsin, statutes of repose, exactly, in fact, quoting from that decision, that statutes of repose are different from statutes of limitations. And as I said before, the key distinction for purposes of applying the borrowing statute is the property, constitutionally protected property right, which comes with the expiration of a statute of limitation under Wisconsin law. Although Mr. Lococo argued that the same right applies or results from the expiration of a statute of repose, there is no authority cited in the briefs or elsewhere that I could locate that supports that proposition. The case law that I'm familiar with, as referenced by Maryland Casualty versus Belasny, is that the running of a statute of repose simply eliminates the remedy that existed in the plaintiff and did not create a right in the defendant. And it was that creation of a right that the legislature sought to extend to the running of a foreign state's statute of limitations as well as the running of a Wisconsin statute of limitations. Other clues to the intention of the legislature can be gleaned from simply the title of the statute, Application of Foreign States' Statutes of Limitation, and by reference to the concept of a cause of action. Under this court's law, as well as Iowa law, a cause of action doesn't arise until there has been both negligent conduct and a discoverable injury which results from that conduct. Of course, a statute of repose doesn't depend upon the occurrence of an injury. It depends solely upon the running of time from a specified date, which would, in a product's case, be the manufacturing or sale date. I see my time is up. I thank the court for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Laufenberg, and thank you, Mr. Lococo. Before I conclude this hearing, I want to tell you that Justice Wilcox, as you see, is not present. He has had surgery, is recovering very well, but could not make it. He will not be participating in this case. Justice Babbage, as you see, left the bench, and he does not feel well. Nothing you people did. And so we're losing him very rapidly. A quorum here is 4, and I call that to everyone's attention. But he will listen to the remaining part of this oral argument on the tape, and to the best of our knowledge, will participate. I just want to explain these empty seats at the moment. So with that, we close 01-2649, Wenke versus Gale Company, and we'll take a few moments in recess to let the students come in. Thank you all.